Hunter Goldberg served as Director for Countering Iranian Weapons of Mass Destruction for the White House National Security Council. He previously served as Chief of Staff for Illinois Governor Bruce Rauner and Deputy Chief of Staff and Senior Foreign Policy Advisor to former Senator Mark Kirk of Illinois, both in the Senate and prior to that when Senator Kirk was a member of the House. In the Senate, Richard emerged as a leading architect of the toughest sanctions imposed on the Islamic Republic of Iran. He was the lead Republican negotiator for three rounds of sanctions targeting at the Central Bank of Iran, the SWIFT Financial Messaging Service, and entire sectors of the Iranian economy. He also drafted and negotiated legislation promoting human rights and democracy in Iran. And given where we are with today's coronavirus, you may want to ask him something about being Governor Rauner's chief of staff. He managed government in America's fifth largest state with oversight of all day-to-day operations, including homeland security, public safety, and public health. Richard?
Thank you so much for that wonderful introduction. And thank you to everyone for joining today and having me. I know it's a captive audience, given everything going on. And you could be streaming Netflix and doing a lot of other things or still working from home. And so appreciate taking the lunch hour to be on this call. In the spirit of coronavirus at homework, if anyone hears a baby screaming at some point, you'll just know it's just part of the new reality. But again, thank you. So as we get into the discussion of the maximum pressure campaign, where we are today and where we're going, obviously coronavirus playing a role, and I'm sure you have many questions on that. I do want to step back first and look at the context for today's conversation. Very important that whenever you talk about the Iran maximum pressure campaign, the president's strategy, that you have to step back and remember where we came from, because it's not a flash moment in time. We're not in a vacuum. We have decades of lessons learned, of consensus that is built up across America on both sides of the aisle when it comes to dealing with the Islamic Republic of Iran. The nature of this regime in Iran, obviously neither Iranian nor Islamic, but calls itself the Islamic Republic of Iran, is one that we've seen affect Americans since 1979. We remember the hostage crisis. We remember the 1980s with the Iranian-sponsored bombings of the Beirut embassies and the Marine barracks. We remember the 1990s, the attacks on Khobar Towers. And we remember all the American soldiers killed in Iraq at the hands of Iranian-sponsored IEDs. Their terrorism has not just been sponsored at Americans, obviously. They are the chief sponsor of terrorism throughout the world and have been for decades. Proxies like Hezbollah, Hamas, now the Houthis in Yemen, all their proxies of terrorism. One of their primary targets, of course, the State of Israel, attempting to encircle them with rockets, precision-guided munitions, sponsoring all kinds of terrorist attacks to threaten the existence of Israel. But always keeping in mind that Israel is the little Satan and that we are the great Satan here in America. And that if anybody believes that this regime ever wants peace long-term with us, their ideology says the complete opposite. We obviously remember 1979 and the hostage crisis, but in fact, we remain in a hostage crisis as this regime takes foreigners hostage for extortion purposes all the time. They keep American citizens hostage even today. They take other foreign nationals as well, Brits, French, others, to use as leverage in trying to gain sanctions relief and other access to world markets. They have a nuclear program that has been kept secret from the world for years. Slow but sure, we've been able to peel the onion back and expose illicit programs, illicit facilities. Even today, just last week, the International Atomic Energy Agency reminding us that there are still things hidden in Iran that we have not accounted for, undeclared nuclear material and sites that Iran will not answer questions about, will not give inspectors access to. And of course, the secret nuclear weapons archive that was kept before, during, and after the JCPOA that was exposed by the Mossad in early 2018. A missile program alongside a robust nuclear infrastructure, making it clear that their long-term goal remains to have the capabilities, if the Supreme Leader chooses, to have a nuclear weapons program and the delivery systems to deliver those nuclear weapons, the obsession with America and Israel, and of course, we think of all the external threats that Iran faces, but like history shows us, an actor like Iran that threatens the world usually has horrible, horrible things that they're doing to their own people at home. That was true of the Soviet Union. It's true of Iran. Human rights abuses that top the world's agenda, abuses of minorities, religious minorities, ethnic minorities. We just saw them kill 1,500 people in the streets late last fall when they came out to protest economic austerity measures. We saw how liberally they shot an airliner out of the sky. Their human rights abuses at home know no bounds, and we should not be surprised that they threaten their neighbors and beyond while they do that. All of that time, remember that until 2015, until the Iran nuclear deal, there was a bipartisan consensus in America that Iran was a top threat to U.S. national security. And we look at the reasons why. We've covered the history legislatively in the Congress, bipartisan support for sanctions on Iran, not just for its nuclear program, actually stopped it because of its sponsorship of terrorism in the 1990s with the Iran-Libya Sanctions Act, which became the Iran Sanctions Act today. We saw piled on terrorism sanctions, missile sanctions, nuclear sanctions, all kinds of sanctions to stop Iran from behaving like the rogue nation that it is. And throughout the 2000s, a ratcheting up of sanctions, again, bipartisan, whether it was the Bush Treasury Department or the Obama Treasury Department, senators of both parties, congressional members of both parties, culminating in 2011 with the Central Bank of Iran sanctions, and then really exploding from there in 2012, congressional push to get SWIFT, the International Telecommunications Messaging Service, for banks to kick Iranian banks off their system. Widespread sectoral sanctions at the end of 2012, took place in 2013, a real buildup of pressure, and then the failure of the Iran nuclear deal right at the peak of bipartisan pressure on Iran. And again, as we look at the Iran maximum pressure today and we see opponents of the policy of President Trump decry a failure of strategy, we have to remember this is in the context of coming after an Iran nuclear deal that gave up all U.S. pressure that had been built up on Iran for years on a bipartisan basis, all in exchange for very narrow, very temporary constraints just on Iran's nuclear program, leaving Iran's nuclear infrastructure completely in place to be able to resume its activities at any time, which we see today. And not just giving Iran billions and billions in sanctions relief and the pallets of cash, but going beyond that. People say the Iran nuclear deal was just about nuclear issues, nothing else. It's actually not true. Under the nuclear deal, Iran was granted access to missiles, access to conventional arms, access to their nuclear program and pathways to nuclear weapons in the long term. It covered far more because it ceded Iran these strategic benefits and things that you've heard of called the sunsets of the agreement. These are dates and time locked into the Security Council resolution governing the deal that says that starting this October 2020, the conventional arms embargo on Iran will lift. Years later, the missile embargo, missile parts and foreign support for their missile program lifts, and then other restrictions lift as well, most dangerously in their nuclear program. The fact that these strategic benefits still exist, even after the United States has left the deal, is something we'll talk about in a little bit. It's a big problem. So in that context, after years of bipartisan support and a horrible nuclear deal, enter Donald Trump as president. And we recall, you know, today it seems so obvious that you would have gotten out of the nuclear deal with Iran. And we take it for granted that the president walked away from the deal. And we see the results of the maximum pressure campaign and say, of course, this was the right thing to do. But it was not conventional wisdom for well over a year in Washington. European allies of the United States who were very wed and still are to the nuclear deal. Former Obama administration officials who traveled throughout Europe, talked to the Iranians, talked to Europeans, talked to members of Congress, and even key officials in the Trump National Security Council at the time, the State Department, and the Defense Department, all pressed the president to stay in the deal and to adopt some sort of face-saving measure with Europe to say that they had fixed the deal while staying in it. But ultimately, the president realized that he could not fix that deal, because all of his leverage was tied up in the deal. All of our sanctions that we would use to roll back Iran in any illicit activities were suspended by the deal. And Europe made very clear, as did the Iranians, that imposing any sort of sanction that was granted relief under the deal would be a violation of the deal. So we really had no other choice but to walk away. And ever since then, we've seen conventional wisdom turned on its head. The maximum pressure campaign that the president has a very clear strategy and, frankly, a very simple strategy. Anybody who says the president has no strategy on Iran apparently doesn't understand a simple way of doing any sort of business negotiation. Maximum leverage with maximum demands to try to achieve maximum results. It's a fairly simple concept. And the end state we're looking for is something along the lines of the 12 demands that Secretary Pompeo presented at the Heritage Foundation back in May of 2018. Now, recall that before the president got out of the deal, people said that America could not reimpose its sanctions alone, that we needed Europe. Otherwise, businesses around the world wouldn't comply. The effect of our sanctions would not be robust. Europe was going to have a blocking statute where they would revive these 1990s type regulations and say any company in Europe that complies with U.S. sanctions will be held accountable and pay fines to the European governments. And of course, European businesses said, you're crazy. We value the U.S. market and the U.S. dollar over you. You can't do anything to us. We're complying with U.S. sanctions. Europeans tried to get Instex, a special purpose vehicle to get around U.S. sanctions, but quickly realized that every tentacle of doing a business transaction, even through a convoluted partnership like Instex, still subjects banks, financiers, investors, insurers, shippers to the reach of U.S. sanctions, and Instex has become a total bust. People said that SWIFT, without a European Union order, because remember, SWIFT is based in Brussels and answers to the regulatory environment of the EU, not the US. They said that SWIFT would only disconnect Iranian banks if the EU ordered it to do so, and that they would not just do so based on US sanctions threat alone. And in fact, that's exactly what happened back in November of 2018. They said that China and India and Russia would all ignore our sanctions. And to a very large extent, they have complied with U.S. sanctions ever since they've been reimposed when a state-owned enterprise has been involved. And we see the results, a complete collapse of the Iranian currency, revenue shortages, money drying up, foreign direct investment out, their oil revenue now to record lows, sinking even further in recent days because of the Saudi-Russia fight. Coronavirus impacting their exports even further, and so any of their illicit cargoes that they still had on the waters likely being reduced even further. And we see this regime reaching a tipping point. We just don't know exactly how close they are to that tipping point. I like to use an analogy of a football analogy, and that is that if the game is in the 100 yards of the football field and we started coming out of the Iran nuclear deal with the Iranians somewhere on our side of the field. We have pushed them back into their red zone. They are somewhere between their 20 and their goal line. And the question that nobody knows because of the opaqueness of their system and the old saying of what we don't know that we don't know is how close they are to their goal line. But we keep pushing them back. And it's clear from their reaction that they are feeling the pressure and know that their day of reckoning is coming. How do they respond? We've seen that in a number of ways over the last year, ever since the president made the decision to end the oil waivers for Iran, which really took the maximum pressure campaign to a new level. The regime began a couple of different parallel tracks of trying to get the president to back down. First track was asymmetric terror attacks. We saw those in form of mines being planted on ships in the Gulf. We saw that escalate a shoot down of a U.S. drone. We saw that with a cruise missile strike on Aramco in Saudi Arabia, taking out at the time 5% of world oil supply. We've seen that with steady rocket attacks throughout Iraq. Well before an American was killed, that was still going on, rocket attacks on the Green Zone and elsewhere. And what we saw at the time was these were trying to get media attention, grab headlines, maybe drive the price of oil up, make it very difficult for the president to sustain maximum pressure, both from an oil market perspective and a political perspective back here at home. The Iranians run a very advanced influence campaign where they do interviews with U.S. media. They talk to U.S. members of Congress of the other side of the aisle. They talk to former Obama administration officials, and they coordinate a very sophisticated influence campaign to try to pressure the president to back down. And every one of these attacks is just enough to get a big media headline, but not enough usually to provoke a direct U.S. military response that they want to avoid. Now, they came into a little bit of an error in feeling big about themselves and escalating that trend line late last year. And of course, Qasem Soleimani paid a price for his miscalculation of the president's unwillingness or willingness to use force, paid that price with his life and others, and a great step by the president to restore deterrence in that front, but without going too far to risk the political support at home that he needs to sustain the sanctions pressure. And we're seeing that playing out once again in the last few days, and we could talk a little bit about that in Q&A on the recent rocket attacks that killed another two Americans and a British soldier. A parallel track that they have in their counter-pressure campaign is their nuclear track. And we've seen that steadily every 60 days over the last few months. They've announced some new breach of their commitments under the JCPOA, mostly trying to scare the Europeans silly to break U.S. sanctions and pay them money to break the sanctions campaign, but also to create pressure here at home, create talking points for the president's opponents, try to undermine him politically, to see that there is both asymmetric terror attacks taking place, nuclear expansion taking place, try to hold up a brave face that they will survive the sanctions pressure, and that really this is a failed strategy that the president must admit to and must provide some sanctions relief to quote-unquote de-escalate the situation. De-escalate, you'll hear that in the media a lot. You'll hear people call for de-escalation. De-escalation is usually code for give them sanctions relief to stop hurting us. In Chicago, where I'm from, we call that a racket, and we know Al Capone, and we have a lot of history in Chicago, and we also know that the best thing to do is not to pay the racket, but to go after the racketeers. And so this is where we have basically a standstill, where the maximum pressure campaign has continued, Iran's expansion of its nuclear program has continued. It continues these incremental asymmetric attacks. And in that environment where almost a game of chicken to see when the Iranians would back down or whether President Trump would back down, enter coronavirus. And while very tragic, and we pray for the Iranian people who are suffering and hope that they are able to access the humanitarian direct goods assistance and technical assistance that Secretary Pompeo has offered, but that the regime has rejected. This has compounded their economic problems on top of the already mounting maximum pressure campaign, the sudden drop in the price of oil globally, and now coronavirus spreading like wildfire inside a completely incompetent regime that has taken steps early on to encourage the spread and continues to have a wholly incomplete approach to stopping it, even though they have the resources to do so. This is now going to take an incredible toll on its economy, further the recession or depression that they were already in. We are seeing the rial in recent days continue its fall. It had stabilized for several months. It's now falling again. And we are also seeing reports of exports that were still allowed, that were non-sanctioned exports, falling even further. So clearly a very tough time for this regime. No wonder you see Javad Zarif going out there and trying to blame the coronavirus in Iran on U.S. sanctions and ask that all sanctions be relieved and that the world break U.S. sanctions at this time of crisis. They do not need sanctions relief to deal with coronavirus. We've offered them technical support and goods. They're getting goods from other countries. They're using this, obviously, as an excuse to just gain an escape hatch from the maximum pressure campaign, and it's something that we can't allow to have happen. They're also being pressured in Vienna at the moment in a story that has unfortunately been really overshadowed by the coronavirus. We saw a board meeting at the IAEA last week following a just incredible report, written report to the Board of Governors from the new Director General, Rafael Grossi, who the United States backed as the new Director General last year, saying that Iran is denying inspectors access to undeclared nuclear facilities in its country, and it is hiding some sort of undeclared nuclear material, and we don't exactly know what it is. The ambassador of the United States to the IAEA last week gave a speech that again went unnoticed because of coronavirus, in which he alleged that the materials that they are hiding could be related to uranium metal, which would be very alarming. Remember that Iran not only kept its secret nuclear weapons archive on ice and apparently has undeclared facilities and material, but it also has an organization called SPND. It's a very shady group, still exists in Iran. It's led, chaired by the founder of Iran's nuclear weapons program, the Ahmad Plan. And it employs a whole bunch of nuclear weapons scientists who worked on that program in the early 2000s. Why you would keep an archive, an organization with nuclear weapons scientists, undeclared nuclear sites and materials, all while claiming that you have no nuclear ambitions, I think we know the answer to that. And so the question is, where do we go from here? Well, number one, the maximum pressure campaign cannot back down. It cannot be provided any sanctions relief prior to a final agreement that achieves all of our demands, that forces the regime to address its widespread malign activities and act like a normal nation. And in fact, when it's feasible, we should be adding to that maximum pressure campaign. We can designate the entirety of the financial sector of Iran for secondary sanctions. Today, dozens of Iranian banks are actually not subject to U.S. sanctions. They're still connected to SWIFT. It is a backdoor to sanctions relief. That should be closed. And we should also impose sanctions on the Tehran Stock Exchange. Interestingly enough, we've seen the Supreme Leader take some of his business empire companies that have been under attack from U.S. sanctions and move them on to the Tehran Stock Exchange to help them with their capitalization. We should impose sanctions on that stock exchange in its entirety. Beyond that, we also have to address the sunsets. And I talked about this at the beginning, and I promise to come back to this. We have to go to the United Nations to end the Iran deal. The president promised us 4 years ago he would dismantle the Iran nuclear deal. And while he did walk away from it and withdraw the United States and reimpose our sanctions, which is fantastic, he didn't actually end the deal. The deal can only be ended by what's called snapback, a process at the United Nations Security Council. If we do not complete that snapback, then they will have the arms embargo lift in October. They will have the missile restrictions end a couple of years later, and they will have their pathways to nuclear weapons a few years after that. And God forbid there is a president who comes in pledged to go right back into the JCPOA with no preconditions. Then they would have all these sunsets ahead of them, one already in the bag in October, and that would be devastating for American national security. If we're able to get them to the table, if they actually agree to negotiate on our terms, two things we cannot do that the Obama administration made grave mistakes on. Number one, no sanctions relief just for talking. Sanctions relief can only come at the end of a process, not the beginning. That was a horrible mistake of the JCPOA. And number two, any agreement has to ensure that the technical infrastructure, the nuclear infrastructure, the missile infrastructure of Iran is fully dismantled irreversibly in an end state. What we've seen today, we cannot repeat, of giving Iran billions of dollars and letting them keep the infrastructure so they have their own sunset, which is a time of their choosing to threaten the world, the United States and Israel. So with that, I'll wrap it up and look forward to questions.
Thank you very much, Rich. You've covered a number of questions that our listeners have sent in, but here's one for you to start with. In general, the administration's policy of maximum pressure does appear to be squeezing the country. At the same time, we say we're not seeking regime change. you mentioned Secretary of State Pompeo's points in terms of what we'd like to see in Iran. Could you give us a little more information on what it is the Secretary has demanded of Iran?
Yeah, it's a very important point and a very important question. You know, unfortunately, in the post-Iraq War era, the term regime change takes on a whole new political meaning, and it is really a hot political football. And people envision the army mobilizing and invading a country and toppling a regime, a la Saddam Hussein. And we don't think of it in terms of regime change like what Reagan pursued with the Soviet Union, which was still talking to the regime, actually negotiating agreements and arms control with the regime, but opining for a day when the regime would fall so that the people, that time the Soviet people, would have a life that was meaningful, that their aspirations would be achieved. And so I really believe that when Secretary Pompeo says that his 12 demands are not regime change demands, they are just simply demands that we ask Iran to behave like a normal nation, is exactly right. And so what we've asked them to do is not a little bit for a little bit, or certainly not a little bit for a lot, which was the JCPOA, but it's wholesale change for wholesale change, behavioral change. And that means that you stop sponsoring terrorism. You withdraw your forces from around the region so that you're not fomenting conflict, bloodshed, wars in Syria, in Lebanon, in Iraq, in Yemen. You declare all of your past nuclear activities, including those that the IAEA is investigating today, and then you agree to dismantle all that infrastructure. If you want a civil nuclear program, now again, when sanctions aren't there and Iran is one of the world's leading oil exporters, you question why exactly they need such a robust enrichment infrastructure. If you want a nuclear power plant, like other countries have, a civil nuclear power plant, that might be possible if you come clean with all your past activities and you agree to dismantle your enrichment facilities, dismantle your heavy water reactor and heavy water production facility, which is a different kind of pathway to nuclear weapons, the plutonium pathway, and you give up all of these missiles that are nuclear-capable missiles that have really no defensive purpose whatsoever. They are only there for a day when you dream of putting a nuclear weapon as a warhead. And so if they're willing to dismantle all that infrastructure, release all U.S. hostages that they have right now detained inside of Iran, this would be a real wholesale change in behavior. And it would mean that Iran is acting like a normal nation. And if you act like a normal nation, the United States treats you like a normal nation. And that means wholesale change in our behavior, where we would commit to full diplomatic and economic relations with Iran going forward. And so I don't know where a negotiation would go. Obviously, these are the demands that we've laid out. The president is the negotiator in chief. He's proven that. But if the North Korean negotiations are any guidepost, he has held firm to key principles in that context of no sanctions relief before a final deal. And any deal has to include the full irreversible dismantlement of the most threatening programs, which are their nuclear program and their missile program.
Thank you. So here's a multi-part question. Particularly in light of that meeting in Vienna that you mentioned, where it appears that the West is building a clearer and clearer picture of what the Iranians actually have. So the first question is, how good do you think U.S. and Western intelligence on Iran is? And then that goes with that, what do we think the best estimate is for breakout time if the Iranians decide to break out? Can they produce more than one weapon? And how would those weapons, if they can build them, be delivered? So that's a big question. Do we know what we're talking about?
Yeah, wow, great questions. I will be careful coming out of the administration, and I will base my answers on open source information and just analytical thoughts as I go through this. Number one, I do believe that we have one of the best intelligence capabilities in the world. We obviously work very closely with allies and partners who share our long-term security concerns about Iran. And I think together we have the best picture possible of what is going on in Iran. With that said, this great coalition has missed many things in the past. There are things in Iran that we just don't know about. And so you do always hold out that simple question of, what if we don't know something else? You think you understand from various indications and warnings and behavior that you can try to observe. We have obviously commercial imagery that has discovered sites in the past. We think about the Israeli discovery of certain sites that Prime Minister Netanyahu spoke to the United Nations about. We know the discovery of the archive itself, which seems like something that was not known beforehand. Additional sites that are now being uncovered with the IAEA investigation. So it does lead you to question whether we know everything, but they have declared a lot. And so while there could be certain things still operating in a silo somewhere, the size and nature of the program that would be in secret is one that we would hope to be able to at some point see something indicating something was going on. With regard to what we know and what they have declared, remember the IAEA does monitor their stockpiles of enrichment. Their sites that have been outed over the years are subject to monitoring. And so all that they're doing today very publicly to try to provoke the president and Europe and gain this leverage ahead of any talks and hopefully try to get some sanctions relief, we are documenting through the IAEA. And so as far as their breakout timeline, and for those who don't know, the breakout timeline is a term of art that came up shortly before the JCPOA and during, is the idea of how long would it take Iran to produce enough fissile material that it would need, if enriched to weapons grade, could then be used to produce a nuclear weapon. Now, there's other factors involved in this, obviously, the timeline of, taking the stockpile to weaponization, the actual physical putting together of a weapon, sort of the weaponization aspect of a nuclear weapon, not just the fissile material production. And so these are two different parts of the equation that you'd have to take account. When we usually talk about breakout timeline in analysis, we're just talking about the fissile material production. Knowing that if Iran just wanted to get a quick boom, like the North Koreans in the past, they don't necessarily need to wait around to build a full nuclear device. They can do something that's just enough to create a detonation and get the world to take notice. And indeed, we would. And so right now, we do believe that based on the last IAEA report, I've seen public analysis, that they do have at least enough stockpile for one nuclear weapon now. Their breakout timeline, depending on what report you're looking at, let's say an average right now, I've seen about 6 months is where their nuclear breakout timeline has fallen to. Could be further reduced from there. They are, again, producing more uranium, enriched uranium every day. People think that this is sort of a every 60-day threat that the Iranians were producing since last summer. But in truth, the minute they decided to blow the cap on their enrichment stockpile, every single day was another violation. And they seem to have been accelerating that production since last November, tripling their stockpile. And so that is very worrisome to be building up a low enriched uranium stockpile that if further reduced, further enriched to weapons grade, could be used for a nuclear device. But on the plutonium front, we would definitely have evidence of that. The heavy water reactor at Iraq, which was disabled as part of the JCPOA, is non-functional, does not have an active reactor core at this time. It is producing heavy water at its production facility adjacent to it. We have reports of them actually exporting heavy water, trying to become a nuclear supplier. But they also have announced that they hid spare tubes from negotiators during the JCPOA, that they could go back to the old design of that reactor at any time, rebuild the core, and restart production, potentially of plutonium, which then could give them a second path to nuclear weapons. So I guess the long and short of it is we know what we know, which is a lot. And we do know that at this point, the crisis, if there is one, is their production of enriched uranium and that growing stockpile. All of the program is a threat to us. And if we are going to learn a lesson from the last few months, it is not that maximum pressure leads to nuclear expansion. It is that you can never cut a deal with a regime like Iran that lets them keep the nuclear infrastructure intact. Because clearly the limits of the deal were on paper alone. And at any time of Iran's choosing, whether there was maximum pressure or whether we sneezed the wrong way, they could just break out the centrifuges and start producing enriched uranium at this rate. That's a scary thing to behold, and it's a lesson for any future negotiations.
Thank you. Let's shift focus just a little bit. The Supreme Leader, Ali Khamenei, is nearly 80, and he has been said to be in ill health. Again, multi-part question. Is there a likely successor? Do we know of one? Secondarily, how strong is the IRGC today? And third, what is the role of the Basiji militia, and are people afraid of that enough to not protest the government? So where are we going?
Yeah, such an important question, and I wish it got more attention and analysis, and it really needs to. Some of my colleagues at FDD do a lot of writing on this and monitoring, but I think the U.S. government, especially now with coronavirus, needs to spend a lot more time thinking through contingency options. Remember, the Supreme Leader, not only his age, but a cancer patient, immunocompromised, and we've seen the reports of so many senior leaders in Iran catching coronavirus, dying of coronavirus. One wonders how closely he is being monitored at this time due to his vulnerability as well. There have been reports over time and analysis of various other clerics that could be supreme leaders in waiting. We've seen the Supreme Leader bring different people to different events, and those who are analysts say, oh, this is a chess move. He's setting this person up to be his replacement. He has a son who he's brought to events who could be sort of a hand over the line with his own blood. That could be taken the wrong way by a lot of people in Iran. But you also have a non-cleric path of the IRGC, obviously controlling at least 40%, probably more at this point, of the Iranian economy, really could step in at some point and act like a traditional military dictatorship rather than the cleric-run establishment that you have today. And you also could see something else occur. There are armed militias throughout Iran. Some of the ethnic minorities have capabilities, but have never really exercised them in a robust fashion. We have people who have come to the streets at certain times in mass. You have an intellectual elite, the former reformers of the Islamic Republic, people like Shirin Ebadi, who for a long time had advocated reformist candidates to stand for election, but have more recently in the last couple of years amidst many of the protests said that the Islamic Republic system itself must change. They've called for a referendum nationally for a different form of government, more representative, to get rid of the theocracy and move into something more like a parliamentary system, or even some who are monarchists believe in a constitutional monarchy a la Britain, with the Shah's son, the heir apparent in waiting to come back. So there's a lot of unknowns there. And I think it would behoove us, as history has shown, not to get too wed to any person or plan or contingency, not to insert ourselves in a way where we tangle ourselves into the domestic whatever happens after the Supreme Leader dies, but stand ready to support legitimate Iranian parties, opposition leaders, people who forswear the radicalism of the Islamic Republic, who want to have normal relations with the West, who want to behave normally. And if there are ways that we can support them at that time, yeah, go ahead.
Let me interrupt you right there. Do we know those people that we might turn to for support? Are we talking to opposition figures?
That I can't speak to, But I will say that obviously we do not have a policy of regime change. And so therefore, there would be things that you would do if you had a policy of regime change that would be allowable, that would not be done without a policy of regime change. And so in a previous life, we did pre-Obama years have various funding streams. I remember serving on the Foreign Operations Committee, and we had a robust Iran democracy program out of the State Department. We found grantees. We did fund opposition parties to build capacities. That could be done again. We do speak to various representatives of ethnic groups, dissident groups, some of the opposition in exile who speak with people in the country. Reza Pahlavi, who is the Shah's son, who does a lot of speaking. He supposedly is in touch with people who are inside the regime and may, you know, if there was a change, stand up for the people. But I think we really need to target our own influence campaign going forward on that middleman section of leadership in the government today, in the IRGC and in the Islamic Republic. If you're at the very top of leadership, you're unlikely to ever let go of the current system, and you will probably fight for it for a long, long time. If you're at the bottom, you're afraid to stand up because you'll get mowed down in the streets. And so the question is, what can we do to influence that middle band of management that are the ones who have to give the orders to shoot, that have to go out to the streets to enforce those orders? And of course, in history, the only one true sign of revolution and a change of government is when the people who are ordered to shoot on their people don't obey those orders.
I'm going to stop you there. I have more questions, but I think that was an amazingly good answer on which to end, except I'm going to ask you if you will come back sometime in the future and talk to us about things that are happening inside of Iran and places that we might put that influence as life changes. Will you come back?
I will come back as many times as you'll have me.
Thank you very much. On behalf of the listeners to this call and the Jewish Policy Center, Richard, I want to thank you for a very, very good way to spend our lunch hour as we're sitting at home, isolated from one another physically, but in one place mentally. Thank you, Rich.
Thank you.